This is River to River. I'm Dean Borg, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day, and there's a treasure of topics waiting. President Obama is next door in Galesburg, Illinois today. We'll have an on-the-scene report, and we'll discuss the political rationale for the trip. And we'll be analyzing Republican chances for gains, maybe even control of the U.S. Senate, and Iowa's role as candidates line up for Democrat Tom Harkin's seat. University of Iowa professor Bruce Gronbeck is joining us, and we'd like to hear from you, too. Politics Day, River to River, right after the NPR News. Dean Borg here with River to River, and we've got a program that is just bulging with information and lots of audio cuts. But right now, President Obama at this hour is just east of the Quad Cities and the Mississippi River in Galesburg, Illinois, on the campus of Knox College. And reporter Scott Stuntz from public radio station WIUM, and that's in Macomb, Illinois, he's there. He's on the line with us to provide an on-the-scene report. Scott, what is the scene?
Well, we're just getting ready for the president. He arrived. He hasn't started speaking yet. There was a big commotion when he arrived here. The National Press Pool just arrived as well. Everyone sort of got out of their seats. Every inch of ground that people can be in, they're in, waiting for the president.
And how many people?
I would say a few thousand. It's the old main gym on Knox College's campus here in Galesburg. The entire gym isn't available for seating, but I would say around maybe 2,000 people.
So it's inside, and luckily it's a cool day.
Yes, I was going to say there's been a heat wave around here, and I think a lot of the political reporters and the audience were hoping to be inside today.
Well, I've been to many of those, and I know they start very early because security takes a long time. And if I'm guessing, and the ones that I've attended, that all the crowd, except for those who may have physical impairments, the crowd is standing, and they've been standing there for a couple of hours at least.
They have been allowed to sit. They were standing out line until recently, and they were standing there for a very long time.
Yeah.
They have been able to be on the bleachers, but everyone's on their feet now.
Is the president speaking yet? You said he's arrived.
He's arrived. He is not started yet. If it gets really insanely loud here in a few moments, you'll know that he has, but everyone's sort of waiting in anticipation right now.
Now, we're being told this will be a major speech on the nation's economy. Any advance information that you have on what he'll be stressing? Did they give an advance copy of the speech?
Not really. I've just been going off with the White House blog and what some of the other White House outlets have been doing. The fact that they are focusing on the middle class's role in the economy. It also kind of dovetails with sort of an earlier speech that then Senator Obama gave from this very campus in 2005. And the White House is sort of touting this as, you know, a full circle comeback to his vision there. And I believe he may be coming on stage right now.
And that means that you need to get back to work, and I'll let you do that. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Scott Stuntz, a reporter for WIUM Public Radio in Macomb, Illinois, giving us an on-the-scene report from the speech that President Obama will soon be making there at Knox College. Bruce Gombrach is on the line with us. Bruce is a University of Iowa Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies. Bruce, hello.
Good morning. How you doing?
How are you judging the significance of this trip by President Obama into the Midwest today?
Well, you know, he's been on this is summertime play for presidents. It's a non-election year, so he doesn't have to follow a lot of candidates, so he can work on his agenda, hoping to put pressure on Congress for the fall and do these kinds of swings, and he's really in his element.
Could this
the various topics he's been picking off. And this, of course, is still going to be a key battle that he has had with the Republicans his entire presidency. So he's hammering one more time, and it's great to listen to him.
I want to go back to what you said. He's in his element. Is that because it's Illinois?
That's because he's got a room full of people who are on his side. He called them out. He promised yesterday that it would be a pretty good speech, a line he used, of course, to describe his 2004 address to the Democratic Convention, his United States of America speech that was indeed a pretty good speech and that launched his career, essentially, his national career. So he is putting a lot of faith in it. He has pushed for a crowd to come. He has been taking all these big issues, the Affordable Care Act, climate change, the race issue and so on, and using these summer months to try and get out in front of them before Congress really gets to work in the fall.
And I'm glad you went down the litany of speeches that he has been making and intends to make. I have got a list of what the White House says he will be doing.
Yeah.
But yesterday, as you alluded to, President Obama spoke to a group of Organizing for Action volunteers in Washington, and it was a preview, as you said, of today's speech in Galesburg. He said he was going back to Knox College because it's the site of his first big speech after being elected to the U.S. Senate.
Talk about where we need to go from here, how we need to put behind us the distractions and the phony debates and nonsense that somehow passes for politics these days, and get back to basics. Refocus on what it is that everybody is talking about around the kitchen table, what people are talking about day to day with their families. And, you know, it's going to be the kickoff to what is essentially several months of us trying to get Washington and the press to refocus on the economy and the struggles that middle-class families are going through, but also for us to start exploring some big and bold ideas, some of which I've offered in the past, some of which will be new, that allow us to consistently, steadily make progress. Now, here's the thing. It'll be a pretty good speech. But as we've learned, you know, I've given some pretty good speeches before, and then things still get stuck here in Washington. Which is why I'm going to need your help.
Well, he previewed a pretty good speech. I suppose that'll be yet to be seen because it's just starting now, as we heard over there in Knox College. But getting back to the well of public opinion, can he reignite the magic that put him in the White House?
Well, you know, of course, it shrunk a little. There was disappointment in the campaign for 2012. That he seemed like he had the world by the tail in the 2008 election, in the 2008 election, and then he didn't seem to get very far with much of anything except the Affordable Care Act. And so especially the liberal wing, of course, wondering, is this the man we thought we had in the White House when we elected him and worked so hard?
Well, Bruce, when I say—
working now to rekindle that, right.
Yeah, when I say reignite, you're right. On what has been accomplished, but also some recent polls are showing he's slipping among the grassroots.
He is, especially in Iowa, of course. His disapproval rating in Iowa, the last poll I saw, was at 54%. He's not in great shape in the center of the world between two oceans here. And there are other places that are going to be like that. And so, obviously, he's trying to get out front to show that he's going to be a leader on these issues. And, you know, especially climate change, which has been a real bugaboo for him. Can he get people to think about the advantages of the Affordable Care Act and not what are being touted as his disadvantages? And, of course, that's what he stressed in his speech there when he was talking about rebates people were getting. He's trying desperately to create that sense of optimism and forward motion. And I say the summertime's the time he's got to do it, because by fall then he's going to be into the full legislative period, and he's going to have much more specific agenda to be working on.
Well, there's much more to become right ahead of us. President Obama's staff earlier this week saying they'll be launching a grassroots initiative, and they've even got a name for it. It's called Action August. And that will be launched on the president's birthday on August 4th, they say. And among other things, they'll be celebrating birthday and, they say, all that's been accomplished, defending and promoting Obamacare. And I'm putting an emphasis on that, defending Obamacare. It's interesting that they still believe defending is needed for that something is already law.
Yeah. Well, because, the attacks have been, the drumbeat has been there. And, of course, he just faced, as he was noted earlier in the week, just about the 40th vote in the House of Representatives to pull it down. They just keep hammering on it when he thinks they should be looking at other issues that are in need of more work than that. It still ends up being a weakness for him, and he's not been able to turn that around to a positive feature. So, I mean, that's certainly what he was trying to do in his last speech, is deal with the positive aspects and that are already in place, and then say even more will be here next year in 2014.
In just a moment, a little later on in the program, I want to play a cut where he's speaking about Obamacare. But right now, he talked about race. And the president last Friday unexpectedly walked into the press briefing room at the White House and made some impromptu remarks about the verdict in the Trayvon Martin George Zimmerman case. The not guilty verdict for Zimmerman, of course, has produced a lot of reaction. And the president said he wanted to put that reaction in context.
You know, when Trayvon Martin was first shot, I said that this could have been my son. Another way of saying that is Trayvon Martin could have been me 35 years ago. And when you think about why, in the African-American community at least, there's a lot of pain around what happened here. I think it's important to recognize that the African-American community is looking at this issue through a set of experiences and a history that that doesn't go away. You know, there are very few African-American men in this country who haven't had the experience of being followed when they were shopping in a department store. That includes me. There are very, very few African-American men who haven't had the experience of walking across the street and hearing the locks click on the doors of cars. That happens to me, at least before I was a senator. There are very few African-Americans who haven't had the experience of getting on an elevator and a woman clutching her purse nervously and holding her breath until she had a chance to get off. That happens often. And you know, I don't want to exaggerate this, but those sets of experiences inform how the African-American community interprets what happened one night in Florida.
And so, Bruce Gronbeck, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies at the University of Iowa, and I'm emphasizing that title now because the question I want to ask is about his effectiveness. We've heard that cut over and over again that we just heard, and the president has a reputation for his polished speaking style, and he's been called the teleprompter president. So how do these off-the-cuff remarks, judging from you as a professor of communication studies, compare with more polished speeches?
Well, of course, on this topic, you'd have to compare it to his 2008 Philadelphia speech, the grand race speech he gave in the campaign when dealing with the issue of Reverend Wright, which was a grand, high visionary speech on kind of the history, the arc of history of race relations and where we had to go as a country, where we had been and where we had to continue to go to continue that arc in a positive direction. Highly formalized speech. I think this was a perfect complementary to that. He obviously didn't want to mess with the legal arguments, even though he's a lawyer. Those are tangled because of the Florida law and the grounds for the decision and so on. So he did what was his great option, which was personalize it.
And do you think that
was the way to go, I think, in this case, and it worked very, very well.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask. You think it's the reaction since those remarks last Friday has been very positive?
I think so. I think so, because here's a man then who is speaking from his personal experience. He is not speaking as President of the United States. He is speaking as Barack Obama, and yet talking on the side of angels, which would have been harder to do if he dealt with the legal issues themselves. They're still causing a lot of problems in the dialogue about this case. I think it was just an excellent way to go. It got him good, positive coverage, and it's one of the kinds of ways that he could have gone without alienating white America, mm-hmm. which he did in many ways in that 2008 speech.
We were talking earlier.
Right.
We were talking earlier about the Affordable Care Act, and I want to mm-hmm. get that cut in now. Speech came as the White House is facing a new Republican push, I think repeated Republican push, to dismantle the health care law. And President Obama used the occasion to demonstrate how the law is allowing those who already have insurance to get what he calls a better value for their buck.
For years, too many middle-class families saw their health care costs go up and up and up without much explanation as to why or how their money was being spent. But today, because of the Affordable Care Act, insurance companies have to spend at least 80% of every dollar that you pay in premiums on your health care. Not on overhead, not on profits, but on you. Now, many insurance companies are already exceeding that target, and they're bringing down premiums and providing better value to their customers. But those that aren't now actually have to reimburse you. If they're not spending your premium dollars on your health care, at least 80% of it, they've got to give you some money back. Last year, millions of Americans opened letters from their insurance companies, but instead of the usual dread that comes from getting a bill, they were pleasantly surprised with a check. In 2012, 13 million rebates went out in all 50 states. Another 8.5 rebates are being sent out this summer, averaging around $100 each.
Well, as we question, you know, why the intent and the timing of this, Bruce Gronbeck. What is the intent here? He seems to be having to sell something that's already law.
Well, he does, and not every state has put in the insurance exchange, even though. It is available and likely would have, in general, positive effects. And, of course, he is being fought on a series of other issues that are going to come and open up in 2014 as well. So here, to turn this into strictly a pocketbook issue, he didn't turn it into a medical treatment issue, a coverage issue. He turned it into a pocketbook issue. This is the summer, obviously, with budget speeches now coming and so on, where that is, he figures, his way back into an optimistic and supportive middle class. Turns it into a pocketbook issue in hopes that he can ride that, not only the Affordable Care Act, but then a broader range of issues as well to his advantage before the fall legislative season.
But Republicans are also thinking they can use it to their advantage.
In an
appearance on the CBS program Face the Nation last Sunday, Speaker John Boehner, Speaker of the House of Representatives, responded to criticism of Congress, some of which was leveled by the president, for repeated voting against repealing that Affordable Care Act without any realistic expectations that those actions by the House of Representatives would have any effect.
We should not be judged on how many new laws we create. We ought to be judged on how many laws that we repeal. We've got more laws than the administration could ever enforce. And so we don't do commemorative bills on the floor. We don't do all that nonsense. We deal with what the American people want us to deal with. Unpopular, yes. Why? We're in a divided government. We're fighting for what we believe in. Sometimes, the American people don't like this mess.
Well, apparently John Boehner feels that this Affordable Care Act, the president himself and his administration calls it Obamacare.
Right.
Some have called it Obamacare derisively. They picked up and called it Obamacare and claim it. Now, who's going to have the advantage, as you see, going into the off-year elections on Obamacare?
Well, I think the Republicans are in a tough, tough place, and they have been for now the third election in a row. But because they have not been willing to go out too far, too fast on offering kind of a positive set of policies to say, here's what Republicans stand for and will attempt to legislate, but rather have spent much of their time, we haven't got time to go into why, on what's wrong and needs to be gotten rid of. They became labeled in 2010 the party of no, and that label has stuck with them. And it frankly is very, very hard to win elections just by being against stuff. And Boehner just played into that with the remarks about we should be judged by what we repeal. I think after the 2012 election, there was some soul searching that went on for about 6-8 weeks, and once again they kind of quit that rather than talking about what they have to say stand for as a party, and are once again pushing hard on the negative, and that is going to be very, very hard on them trying to win all the seats that they think they could in both the Senate and the House this next time around.
President Obama earlier in the week said his first term was devoted to fixing what was broken rather than forward progress, and his second term has to be different. Do you think that the series of speeches now is getting to what he hopes will be that agenda and possibly creating the momentum? Is that the reason now for the series of speeches, some of which we've played cuts from already and others to come later in the program?
Oh, I think very much so. You know, the issue that has, I think, been hardest on the liberal wing of the party has been climate change. Even though he's done an awful lot with executive order, he's not put forward a legislative agenda on it. This, I think, is a place where he wants to be judged with having forward motion. Getting the Affordable Care Act actually implemented before he leaves office, I think, is very dear to his heart, because then that will stand as a terribly important piece of legislation. The race issue is certainly a different kind. It's because it tends to be state legislation rather than national legislation that makes the difference here. But he wants to at least get his oar in on that. And, of course, the economy, if he can actually get a budget through this Congress, he will have an awful lot to be sleeping well over.
We'll talk more about timing as we go on with the program after the news. But right now, we are going to break for news. And we have with us Bruce Gronbeck from the University of Iowa, Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies. And we'll be bringing Chris Larimer on from UNI in the second part of the program. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Dean Borg, and we have with us Bruce Gronbeck, who is the University of Iowa Emeritus Professor of Communication Studies. Bruce, still with us?
I'm still here.
Okay. And Bruce, we're going to bring on a colleague of yours from the University of Northern Iowa. He's Associate Professor of Political Science there, Chris Larimer. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Dean.
And he's in our studios on the UNI campus. Chris, you've been analyzing, and Bruce, you probably know about this, but
I do.
He's been analyzing voting patterns in Iowa during recent election cycles. And Chris, you're concluding that As that applies to the high-profile run for the U.S. Senate seat that Democrat Tom Harkin's leading, that Eastern Iowa's voting record is good news for the Democrats.
Yes, it is. When you think about Bruce Braley in the race for the U.S. Senate, you know, I think there was a lot of surprise about why there was not a big-name Republican jumping into the field into that Senate race, because this was supposed to be a high-profile Senate race. As you mentioned, the U.S. Senate is potentially in balance here. But when you look at the political geography of the race, you start to see why maybe Bruce Braley has a clear advantage. And the way to do that is, you know, I just looked at there are 23 counties that Bruce Braley has represented in the first district, both before redistricting and then after redistricting. You take those 23 counties and you look at the 2008 Senate race for Harkin's seat when he was up against an opponent, Chris Reed. Harkin got about 35% of the vote share from those 23 counties in that race. His top five counties in that race came from that first congressional district, Black Hawk, Clinton, Dubuque, Linn, and Scott counties. But then if you start to take a step back and you actually look at the last time there was an open or there was a Senate race in Iowa in an off-presidential year, that was 2010, you had Senator Grassley and Roxanne Conlin. Just over 1 million voters voted in that election. It was about a 54.5% turnout. If you assume a similar turnout rate next year and you recalculate the numbers based on 2012 party registration numbers, that would tell you that Bruce Braley needs to get about 545,000, 550,000 votes to win the election in 2014. What you can do then is go back and take those 23 counties, look at the vote share that Harkin got in those 23 counties, and basically extrapolate or recalibrate those numbers for based on 2012 party registration numbers. And if you do that, what you find out is in those 23 counties that Braley has represented or is currently representing, he can expect to receive about 326,000 votes if he gets the same if he wins those counties by the same margin that Harkin did in 2008. That puts him about 60% of the way to that magic number of 545,000, 550,000. Of course, in any statewide race, you know, obviously Polk County is going to be critical. So if you look at the vote margin for Harkin in 2008 in Polk County, and again, recalibrate those numbers for based on 2012 numbers, you can expect Braley to receive about 130,000 more votes. That gets him up to about 455,000 votes. He's also going to be looking at Johnson County. We know that Johnson County is very much a Democratic stronghold. Based on some numbers I've run based on party registration numbers from 2000 to 2013, Johnson County is probably the sixth most Democratic county in the state. Again, assuming that Braley is able to win by similar margins to Harkin in 2008, Braley is going to get another 53,000 votes, and that ends up putting him over that 545,000 vote margin. And so in other words, he's going to get about 54.6% of his vote share from 25 counties, and he's actually going to get almost all the way up to that 545,000 votes from only 25 counties. He gets about 93% of the way there. And so you assume he's going to get some votes in Woodbury County, some votes in Pottawatomie County.
But Woodbury, be Sioux City, and Pottawatomie, right. Council Bluffs.
Exactly.
And you haven't mentioned Ames, Story.
No, and I didn't even include that in the calculation. So, you know, assuming he carries Story County with Ames and Iowa State, the political geography is really on his side. And I think, and I imagine that Republican insiders have done the same calculations, and it really favors someone like Bruce Braley running from the first district, using those counties to his advantage. And of course, but the one big caveat on all of this is that 2008 was very much a big year for Democrats. 2014, we really don't know yet. So to assume that he would get the same margins that Harkin did in 2008 is maybe a bit of a stretch. But again, I think what I would expect, I guess, going forward is Braley's going to use those 23 counties to his advantage. And we're going to see a lot of Bruce Braley in Polk County, a lot of Bruce Braley in Johnson County.
And in the 23, just to reiterate, the 23 counties are the ones in the first congressional district that he's already been representing and people there who know him well. And then you're saying throw in Polk County,
yep.
Johnson County,
yep.
Possibly Story, Woodbury, mm-hmm. and Pottawatomie out of the western border,
right.
And he's got it.
He's got it, yeah. If we assume a similar turnout rate from 2010, he's got it wrapped up.
Now Bruce, what do you think about what you've just heard, number one? And then also, does this portend then that we're going to see something like the presidential race where they're concentrating on the Electoral College and the electoral votes? That is, some states didn't even see, I think there were states that didn't even see a presidential candidate in the last election during the campaign because the candidates were campaigning and emphasizing their campaign, directing their spending on certain states. Is it going to be the same way in counties this time, in Iowa?
They'll certainly be picking their campaign stops that way. You figure that, especially on the Democratic side, they tend to come into Iowa in a presidential year. The presidential candidates probably somewhere between 30 and 42, three times, something like that. And if you look at how many times they come and where they go, they obviously are going for the Democratic population centers, most of which are going to be in eastern Iowa, and getting into Des Moines and into Story County. The western part of the state doesn't see them very often. They certainly do some swings out there because they've got campaign workers they want to keep fired up, and they'll use some surrogates out in those places as well. Somebody else campaigning for them, but they're going to follow these kinds of numbers very, very much, especially certainly the Democratic side, and that's the side that I've watched the most closely in my years in Iowa, and that tells a story, because Iowa still remains a battleground state. Not only because it's so evenly splits the presidential vote, but also, of course, because of its positioning as number one. You're going to, in the battleground, by now they're concentrating this last election, most of their spending and their appearances in 12 to 15 states, and then whittling that down as you get closer to the election to about 8 or 9 of the closest calls in that last couple weeks before the election. That's just the way politics is run these days.
Well, Chris Larmer, what does this mean? I'll run down the candidates as I recall them now for the Republican nomination. Bruce Braley doesn't have another candidate, and he's not going to be, as it looks right now, involved in a primary. But the Republicans have State Senator Joni Ernst, former U.S. Attorney Matt Whitaker, businessman Mark Jacobs, David Young, he's a former aide to Republican U.S. Senator Charles Grassley, and then Sam Clovis, a Sioux City radio host. Mm-hmm. Now, already, and this was confirmed by a poll out this past Monday, that none of the candidates, including Bruce Braley, seems to have a significant name identification with a cross-section of Iowa. But with the research that you've just outlined for us, what does this mean for Republican candidates? What would you be, if you were a campaign manager, be advising Republican candidates? And it may be an advantage to them that they have a primary coming up.
Well, it may be an advantage to them. I mean, certainly they can hopefully emerge from their perspective. They want to emerge from that with a stronger candidate who's gone through debates, who is well-versed when it comes to the general election cycle. But, for Republicans generally, I think this starts to explain why it was maybe such a blow not to have someone like Tom Latham run against Bruce Braley. Tom Latham, currently representing Polk County as well as Pottawatomie County. So you have Des Moines and Council Bluffs, where you see a lot of voters. You're talking about a big percent of the vote share. This starts to explain why maybe political geography and location is important, and familiarity with voters. Braley, he's familiar to a small subset of voters, or at least a small geographic set of voters in Iowa, but that geographic set is a large percent of the vote share that we can expect coming in the Senate race. And so I think for Republicans now, they're struggling to catch up with that, because you can be a Republican from western Iowa. You might be a Republican from some very strong Republican areas in the state, either northwest or southwest corners of the state. But as far as the percent of the vote share and turnout, it's relatively small. You think about someone like State Senator Joni Ernst from Red Oak down in Montgomery County. That's a very Republican county, but it's a relatively small number of voters there. So I think it starts to point to the challenges that Republicans are facing right now.
Bruce, you see it the same way, because I remember on an Iowa Press program several months ago when Congressman Steve King from the 4th District was weighing a possible run for the Republican nomination for the U.S. Senate to run for that Harkin seat. He made the comment from the research that was coming into him that he used the words, it'll be an uphill climb for Republicans, and apparently that's confirmed in what Chris Larmer is saying.
Well, but it is, although what you also... I mean, you also have to look at, you know, for the Republicans, they do have a champion that they can look at, which of course is Grassley. That here's a man who was able to put who's been able to put together a good Republican turnout, a large percentage of the independent vote, and even some crossover votes that get tired of the kinds of candidates that have been thrown up against him, to come out with solid victories. It's possible that the Republicans can do this, but again, it is. I agree with Representative King that it is an uphill battle because you've got to create enough interest, especially in the independent, whatever it is in Iowa these days, 30% or more, that you have to get them to turn out in significant numbers and on your half, and that isn't always easy in a state like Iowa.
And let's go back to what we were talking about earlier in the program then. Are there issues that can turn nationally to influence the Iowa senatorial race, or is it all politics is local and this is an Iowa race?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. You know, when you look at what predicts how people vote and the direction they vote, a lot of it comes down to the economy. And so, and particularly state and federal unemployment rates. And so if you see a significant turn in perhaps the federal unemployment rate, it starts to go up significantly. Maybe that turns the tide the Republican way, and then a Republican candidate might have a better chance come 2014. But right now, I think it's still a little bit like 2012, where we really don't know what kind of year it's going to be. And that's coming off a 2006, 2008, where that were very much Democratic years, 2010, very much a Republican year. I think 2012 and 2014, are a little bit more difficult to assess at this point.
Bruce, I don't want to cut you off on this subject, but I'm going to move on unless you have
something. That's all right. I'd have the same exact answer. It's the economy that bleeds down and floats back up. It goes both ways. That is the issue that will just get stamped on the whole election process.
You know, what I want to go to now is 4th District Congressman Steve King. We've been just referring to him, and he's drawing some criticism right now from his own party for remarks he made about so-called dreamers, and that's those under age 35 who were brought into the U.S. illegally by their parents. And that group, as you know, would be granted permanent resident status under what is called the DREAM Act. In an interview with Newsmax last week, Congressman King said, as Congress debates comprehensive immigration reform, many raise the question about what to do about those 11 million dreamers, some of whom have excelled.
We have to do something about the 11 million, and some of them are valedictorians. Well, my answer to that is, and then, by the way, their parents brought them in. It wasn't their fault. It's true in some cases, but they aren't all valedictorians. They weren't all brought in by their parents. For everyone who's a valedictorian, there's another 100 out there that they weigh 130 pounds and they've got calves the size of cantaloupes because they're hauling 75 pounds of marijuana across the desert. Those people would be legalized with the same act. And until the folks that want to open the borders and grant this amnesty can define the difference between the innocent ones who have deep ties with America and those who have been, I'll say, undermining our culture and civilization and profiting from criminal acts, until they can define that difference, they should not advocate for amnesty.
Well, those comments by Congressman King, I've heard them at least a couple of times this morning on national networks, so it's getting a lot of attention. Congressman King's statement, before I ask for your reaction, Bruce Grunbeck and Chris Larimer, Congressman King's statement drew sharp criticism from House Speaker John Boehner, and he calls those remarks wrong and hateful. Now, and House Majority Leader Eric Cantor called them inexcusable. That's pretty strong condemnation from members of his own party. So any political consequences for Congressman King, if not in his own district, on the Hill? Chris?
Well, probably not from his own district. It really, frankly, he's in a Republican district, and I don't think it's going to hurt him a lot. Nationally, it does hurt him because the Republican Party is trying to appeal to a segment of voters that they lost pretty handedly in 2012. I think the Democratic Party picked up about 73% of the Hispanic vote in the 2012 election. So for Republicans nationally, politically, this is very bad, but for Representative King in his own district, this is probably not going to hurt him a whole lot.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Bruce?
Well, it's right. You know, it's coming at a critical time, but he's been you know, fighting the immigration reform straight through ever since early spring. And furthermore, his party certainly is used to King making similar kinds of remarks. Maybe not quite that strong, but he's not been afraid to make very sharp statements. You know, I always say that he and Michelle Bachmann coupled together make for a very interesting Midwestern pair in the House because they both will shoot hard from the hip. He won't be hurt locally. He is all but invulnerable. And I don't think they're going to be willing to go so far as to yank committee appointments or anything like that, as that would raise more havoc than it's worth. I think they end up, he was also called inflammatory, all these other kinds of things that are going on. The Republicans will just wait for the news cycle to spin on a couple more days and let this die.
Well, is it going to die, or could it even spill over into the Republican chances of flipping the U.S. Senate, the retaking the Senate, Bruce?
I don't think so. I can't imagine anybody running for the Senate, and the Republicans certainly have at least an interesting and I think positive chance to get the Senate this time around. I don't think anybody running for those offices are going to be in that kind of position. There certainly will be resistors to a comprehensive reform bill, immigration reform bill, but the usual line of argument is always there. Let's get the wall built first, so let's get the barrier in and security down, and then we'll talk about other ways of handling the population that's already here. A wonderful delaying tactic. Most, I think that's going to be where most conservatives take their stand. With the possible exception of my good friend here in Colorado, former Senator Tancredo, who's like Steve King in a lot of ways. But no, I don't think it'll hurt him.
Dan in Des Moines is calling and has a comment here. Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that a lot of people like to work Congressman King over for that because they have an agenda. But I'd like to ask you guys, why you would think that wouldn't be right to sort through the people that are here and treat those that have been here and doing the right thing one way and those who haven't been or who are drug runners. I mean, when you have a wide-open amnesty program that doesn't sort through all that, it's unfair to the American taxpayer. It's unfair to those people in the right way. I don't get why you're jumping on King, quite honestly.
Well, I don't think our guests are jumping on Congressman King. What they're saying is
that. Look, you just asked if it's going to hurt him. Maybe you could say, why are they jumping on him? Why is Boehner doing it? He's got a vested interest in trying to buy Hispanic votes. I'd jump on him.
I see what you're talking about. And I thought you meant our two guests were jumping on Congressman King because I think they both said it's not going to hurt him in the 4th District. But what you're saying is nationally and among the leadership. Chris?
Okay, go ahead, Chris.
Okay. So I think what Speaker Boehner and what Leader Cantor are doing is they've seen the results from 2012, and they know that they were hurt with the Hispanic vote, and they view this as a statement coming out of Congressman King as something that's going to continue to hurt them with the Hispanic vote going forward in 2014 and 2016. So I think
They're
jumping on that statement from a political perspective.
You wanted to say something.
The other thing I'd point out, is that every bill or proposal I've seen so far for both Dreamers and their parents will include extensive work on background checks. So I think there will be a strong attempt to sort out the sheep and the goats in this kind of situation and not do a blanket amnesty program. I think that's a misnomer.
You know, one thing, I'm going to go to it really quick here. Governor Branstad is taking heat for a speeding incident and state troopers clocking him at 84 miles an hour, and he wasn't driving, a trooper was. But Governor Branstad has something to say at a news conference this week on it.
Throughout this entire process, it was the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Public Safety who coordinated the investigation. At no time was there any involvement by me or my office into this investigation. But I am glad to learn the full truth today, and I hope the public is given the same access as soon as possible.
Quickly, Bruce Gronbeck, have you been following that at all where you are?
Just a little bit.
Okay.
I get some news. And interestingly, in that speech, he said that he's going to make sure that the State Patrol follows all the laws.
Yeah.
And apparently he wasn't watching the speedometer in this case to see that they were this time. He avoided that issue, but I think the rest of his statement is pretty much what you would expect him to do, plus opened up a couple of additional issues like unregistered license plates and so on for certain state officials. So I think he did a decent enough job of keeping covered.
We have to leave it there. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Bruce Gronbeck and Chris Larimer, University of Iowa, and UNI political science and communications professors. River to River, produced by Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Statton. The executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Dean Borg, and River to River is produced by Iowa Public Radio News.